Welcome to the Humans and AI Podcast, powered by AI Frontier Network. I'm your host, Flor La Orga. Each episode, we dive into the human story shaping artificial intelligence through the journeys of entrepreneurs, builders, and leaders. We explore the insights, challenges, and visions for the future of AI and humanity. Let's uncover the human side of AI together. Hi, Dinesh. Thank you very much for joining to the Humans in AI show. I'm very happy to have you here. I've been reading a little bit of what you've done. So yeah, let's get into it.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me, Flor. Great to be here.
You're welcome. Thank you. So you've been a 3-time founder and you've got more than 12 years experience in tech startups and as well scaling them. So I would like to understand what is that ambition behind that? It's very exciting journey, but I know that's very challenging as well. So I would like to know, why do you choose that career path of that journey?
I think for me, it was a bit accidental. So I graduated and then I was working with Deutsche Bank for a year. I was working there as a business analyst. While I liked my role over there, I was not very happy or very satisfied with the kind of impact my work was creating. And I said, hey, why not? Let's at least give a shot to trying to build a company. Now, I come from an engineering and tech background, and that's all I knew at that point of time. So started building the first company, really loved the experience, really loved the journey. And then I felt that this is the right thing for me to do. After I exited my first company, I did try to evaluate other career paths, including things like joining somewhere as a product manager, joining a venture fund, etc. But yeah, I could not really feel the motivation and the drive to do it. I think the founder journey is, as you rightly mentioned, it's extremely hard and there is absolutely no doubt about it, but it just feels the right thing for me to do as a person.
I found it very fascinated what you did. I think that you're also very young. Or you look like, at least. Could you take us back to the early days of this first startup that you've done? It was ASN Jobs. That's the right name. So what was the biggest emotional personal challenge scaling it to almost 50 million ARR?
So ASN Jobs was a recruitment startup in India. It was a tech recruitment company. We ended up starting it in 2014 with my co-founders. I ran it for about 4 years, scaled out to about 50 million in revenue, and then eventually sold it to OLX. So I think I saw the journey from starting very early to then the scale-up phase, finding the product market fit, and then the scale-up phase. And each phase has different set of challenges. But I think overall, if I have to point at one thing, then the biggest challenge is always to build the team. And like the situation at that time was very different compared to what it is right now. Currently, we see people claiming to build one-person unicorns. That was certainly not there 10 years back. And if you have to build a large company, the team has to be there. And then the team needs to be great. So building the right team, hiring the right set of people, getting them to stick with you and growing the company, that's actually the biggest challenge. And that was also like the biggest learning for me, something that I have carried across other companies as well.
Talking about teams in the startups, I read a post of you actually saying that today, in this era, is more difficult to build a startup than before, or now it's more difficult. Why do you think so?
So you actually read that post, yeah. I think that's a slightly controversial post, but yeah, I would love to share how to think about it and what has changed over the last 10 years. And for me, this is a third company. I have built teams across all three companies. See, 10 years back, and typically if you look at most startups, a lot of startups will prefer to hire generalists because most of the problems in the startups are not defined. You want people who have a good intellect and a knack for problem solving. And then you want to throw them at very difficult problems with the hope that they will be able to solve it on their own. Now, what this needs is people who are driven, people who are extremely passionate, and people who want to do the work because they love doing the work and because it's a drive that comes internally from them as compared to somebody trying to constantly push them. Another big thing that is required to be able to do this is having an impeccable learning curve. And all of this was true 10 years back. Now, the world has actually changed in a lot of ways. And I would say largely because of COVID and what the world has seen in the last 3 to 4 years, a lot of culture around work from home. And there is nothing wrong or right about it. It's just that a lot of skills that the startups need, those skills do not exist anymore. So a lot of people out there, they're looking for work-life balance, which is hard to find in a startup ecosystem. A lot of people are actually addicted to social media, which is a massive problem. And if I have to give an anecdote from my personal experience, so I have always been a big fan of hiring freshers out of engineering colleges and then spending about 3 to 6 months in training them. And I would personally spend a lot of time in training them. And typically in most of these trainings, I would recommend them to read 2 to 3 different books. And people were absolutely open to doing that. And they would actually do it 10 years back. But now the hiring that I have been doing over the last 3 years, people tend to spend a lot of time on alternate channels. They tend to spend a lot of time on different OTT platforms, Netflix, social media, etc. So the priorities have changed. And for good or for bad, most of these priorities are not what actually helps startups build a large company. And yeah, and hence this is a massive challenge that has come up. And most of the startup founders, people in my network, some of the companies that I've invested in, everybody has a very similar feedback to what is happening with the work ecosystem right now.
Yeah, great. So thank you, Adinesh. I saw that post. And I found it, okay, I would love to kind of talk to you about it because I found it interesting. I think that as well, everything changed and it looks everything easier because with AI and automation, everything is easier to build. But at the same time, it's challenging the way that everybody can build. So who are you going to build with? There's no team anymore. Almost. I don't know. Well, that's kind of another topic. Okay, let's focus on the next one. So I realized that most of your startups been built in India, right? Asan Jobs and the other one. So why do you choose to move to US? Because I think that Robbie Lan, what I've seen, it's in San Francisco. Because you've got a lot of success in India. So why do you kind of decide to move to US?
I think that's a great question. And it has like a bunch of learnings over the last 10 years. So I started my first company in India. I built it for about 4 years, ended up selling it to OLX. Then I was in OLX for a while, and OLX is a global company. At that time, it was operating in about 40 odd countries. So I looked at how the jobs business is doing in other countries. And I think one of the problems I had at that point of time was for the amount of effort that I had put in India, building the business in India and selling to customers in India, maybe the reward had not been large enough, right? The revenue, the scale had not been large enough. And that's just the nature of the Indian market. The Indian market is not very deep. And I think that's slightly problematic. So when I started building the second company, which was a gaming company, while we were building from India, we were a global company from day one. We had gamers in Philippines, Brazil, Turkey, who were there on the platform, active on the platform, and some of the developed markets also. And then when I decided to start the third company, which is the current one, where we are doing AI agents for customer support, we wanted to be a global company from day one. So we started building from India, but the idea was that within 6 months, I'll move the base to SF. The engineering team will continue to be in India and I will sell to customers in the US market. And I think there is all the reason to actually do it because while the product is designed from India, it's actually designed for the US market. And the market is a lot deeper. The buying power of software is a lot higher. And people have been buying software for 30 years over there. India is a relatively new market. Buying software is only 10 years old in India, right? So it makes all the sense for engineering teams from India, if they manage to build global products, to just move the base to US and sell in the US market. And by the way, I'm actually seeing a lot of this trend. A lot of companies from India who are building in AI, they're actually moving their bases to the US market.
Yeah, makes total sense. Like Silicon Valley, the San Bay Area, all this the AI boom in there, so for sure. So right now, your third company is Robbie Lan, right? Robbie Lan is building AI agents to automate the customer support. What inspired this model and how it has changed the way your clients think about AI?
We do AI agents for both pre-sales and customer support. We have been building it for about 1.5 years now. And there have been like a lot of learnings over the last one and a half years. So I think the biggest learning that, and I can probably say that it's the biggest learning by margin, is that it's easy to build a demo over a weekend, but it's actually very hard to build a production grade product, right? And the market is massively crowded, where there are a lot of companies which are saying that, hey, we have a product, we have a functional product, we do this, we do that. But when you take those products and put them in production, most of them actually break. They don't really do a good job of it. And of course, like single-handedly, the biggest learning is building a high quality product is not as easy as it looks like, right? The second learning would be that there are real gains to be had, right? And I know that there are a lot of naysayers around AI and AI technology in the market, but we have been using AI for our customers. We have been using AI for our internal processes. And we know that the gains are real, the gains are substantial, and the gains are meaningful for anybody who is using it, right? So the technology is here to stay. The third thing is, I think there is going to be a massive disruption, right? And a lot of people actually underestimate it, but we're seeing it firsthand with our customers who are using our tech, and some of the customers are using some other tech in AI. I think the disruption is going to be massive, especially to the employment, the entire employment space, who will be relevant in a job, who will not be relevant in a job, how much can AI automate? I think that is going to be phenomenal. And the cost at which, and like just to give you some numbers, when we started building out last year in April to what we're doing right now, for the same kind of work, we are paying about 100 the cost. So basically, if I was paying like $100 to do something using AI last year, I'm just paying $1 to do the same thing using AI, right? So the cost benefit and the speed at which the accuracy is improving, the quality is improving, that's just mind-boggling, right? So the change is real. It is here. But building the product is not that easy, right? So good engineering teams, good product teams will eventually be able to crack it.
Okay. Do you have any successful story of a user client that use your product, your tool,
your software? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We actually do a lot of work in e-commerce and fintech. We work with one e-commerce company that does about 100,000 customer conversations on chat and about 40,000 on ticket. So there is a company called Aditya Birla Fashion and Retail. They're actually very large in India. So we work for one of their brands and their entire system runs on our system. And our AI agents actually resolve their customer conversations across both chat and the ticketing system. So typically our systems are able to touch about 95 to 96% full deflection, and the rest are passed to the human agents. And we are continuously improving the accuracy of it. We work with a e-commerce healthcare brand and we do pre-sales for them. So they typically get about 60,000 to 70,000 conversations a month. And this again on chat. And a lead collection agent is able to engage the customer, book a demo for them, and do all of that with roughly about 11 to 14% conversion rate. Yeah, and there are like a lot of other stories which are there. But broadly, the power and the value that we bring to the table for our customers is that the AI agents are highly personalized, they're highly dynamic, they're available 24/7, and they're able to do highly complex tasks from calling different tools, booking different calendars, setting up a demo, making a call to the customers, etc.
As you use AI more like frontier customer interaction, how do you think about trust and empathy in the design of these systems?
I think that that's a great question and it's absolutely critical. So there are a few things that are becoming more and more important as you start using AI for customer-facing, front-facing roles. So A, the conversational agents, they need to be very good in understanding the user and having the right set of tonality to respond to the user. They need to be empathetic to the situation. And we have seen a lot of fail videos and fail stories where the customer is in distress, but the AI agent is not able to figure that out and it responds something which is not polite. So absolutely important. And I think this is becoming more and more accurate. And at least since the last year, what we have seen, our accuracy in terms of identifying the customer tone and sending out the right reply, that itself has gone up by about 22%. So we were at about 75% when we started last year. Currently, our agents are at about 97%. I think the second big concern, which is also a valid concern that a lot of enterprises have, is around data privacy and data security, right? How do you ensure that the PII data is not exposed to the LLMs? How do you ensure that the data is not leaked? And how can people actually trust the underlying tech? And like a lot of the infra has been built over the last 1 year. We have a bunch of things that are there in place. And these are like all valid concerns, right? Data security in general is becoming more important. And brands and large companies have all the reason to be like extremely particular about the PII not spilling over into the LLMs. It's a lot is being done on that front also. And I think that's the right direction in which the world is moving.
And how does your team embrace AI? Not only AI, but AI agents, because there's all this thing about AI is replacing your job, right? So how do you embrace that?
I think that's a great question. So I'll tell you how we think about AI. So A, we are an AI first company. Almost everybody in the team, we are actually a very small team. We're about 20 people, but almost everybody in the team knows how to use AI and they use AI for most of the work on a daily basis. I train some of the people on some of the things using AI, and there are other people who do the same thing. So the general protocol that we follow, and I think this is a good framework that most of the companies should follow, we first arrive at what essentially needs to be done, and we make a process for it. And then the human will do that for a couple of weeks. And their task in that duration is to collect all the information, collect all the intelligence, find all the pitfalls, figure out all the pitfalls. And at the end of 2 weeks, they need to have a very clear cut SOP that what is a standard operating procedure to do this. Then we sit and evaluate, is this something that can be automated using AI? And if the answer is yes, then there are a few people in the team who are automation experts. They just go ahead and do the automation. Couple of things that we're still trying to work on is A, how do we enable everybody in the team to do the automation? B, how do we enable everybody in the team to start writing better standard operating procedures? And the general philosophy is that we're not looking at AI to actually replace you. We do intend to keep the team small, but essentially we want a single human to start doing the work of 4 different people, right? And each person should operate as an individual task master that, hey, if you're looking at marketing, you're able to figure out everything in marketing to the extent that you're empowered and capable enough to actually automate the task also by yourself. And I think that's a general philosophy that most companies should follow, that start with a human, figure out what is a repetitive process, what can be automated, what is a standard operating procedure, and then build an agent around it. We're also planning to start using some boilerplate agents that are available in the market. But yeah, that's still in the works, but that will also come through very quickly.
Okay. And do you believe that maybe the future for sure, 100%, but in 5 years, everything can be automated by AI? Like maybe not, like not human interaction, let's say, just to put it more dramatic.
So I think that's a tricky question. And one question that people generally ask, so my first company, we used to do entry-level hiring. So that was all about getting job to people. And this company looks like taking job away from people. So one of the questions that a lot of people ask is, why is such an orthogonal shift from the philosophy in the first company to the philosophy in this company? But without presenting like a doomsday scenario, right? Let me just try to portray what I truly believe is going to happen, right? So AI is going to take away most of the jobs, right? And I absolutely believe that. And that's actually a very scary situation. If you have been doing something which is pretty mundane, you would just become redundant, right? Because AI agents are smart enough, they're capable enough, they're cheap enough, that it will be absolutely irrational for companies to not use them, right? Now, the key question to answer is that in such a world, what is a skill set that you need to have to actually stay relevant? And I think the most important skill set is you need to know how to use AI really well, how to write AI agents, how to test AI agents, how to ensure that they work well, how to figure out what they can do, what they cannot do. And the second thing that is the most important is actually to figure out what is good output versus bad output, right? So most of the things, I'll not say most of the things, but I'll say about 40-50% of the things that AI generates today, they're not actually high quality, but it is actually changing the bar. So AI is actually changing the bar of what companies should expect. So if you're using an AI model or if you're building an AI agent and the model throws a prompt and then the model throws an output, if you're capable enough to know what is a great output and what is not a great output, and then iterate to improve it, then you're extremely valuable. But if you think that your only job is to create basic stuff, basic SEO articles, write a LinkedIn post, etc., the future does not look that bright. And it's going to be a lot of issue and a lot of struggles in the years to come.
Okay. Thank you for sharing. I know it was a bit tricky question, but...
I know it's a extremely pessimistic view, but I actually believe that's what is going to happen. We see a lot of that happening right now, and it is only going to accelerate.
Okay, great. So what's your take on the balance between efficiency and human employment support roles, especially as automation becomes more capable?
What would you mean by that?
What I mean is, since AI is becoming an automation and all the things that you're using AI agents, right, to automate your customer support for Robilon, what do you think is the balance between human employment and support roles since we have AI? So what is the balance we should take?
So I think support roles are going to go down significantly, right? So that's the first thing. So I'll share some data. Typically, highly automated customer support in India would traditionally, pre-AI, be at about 65 to 70% automation, right? And about 30 to 35% will be handed over to a human. With AI, this number is already touching about 90%, right? This is in e-commerce, which means that there is a direct impact of about 25-ish percent of queries that are now being handled by machine as compared to being handled by a human, right? So that's the first problem. The second issue largely is that most of the L1 and L2 queries will be completely automated. So you would need a lot fewer people, but you would need smarter people who can handle complex things because all the simpler things will be taken by machines. I was having a conversation with a few BPOs based out of Philippines and Colombia, and they have already started seeing the impact. A lot of their customers in the US market, they have started reducing the number of seats that were there in these BPOs. So yeah, so that is going to take actually a massive hit. The headcount is going to go down. Most of the support guys, they will be the ones who are handling L3 queries. L1 and L2 will almost practically disappear. Now on the flip side, few things that I think are extremely important and customers absolutely love it. One, because L1 and L2 queries are handled by the machine. If I have a basic query, an L1 and L2 query, I have an AI agent who is available 24/7, right? And this had been one of the biggest challenges I've had in the past, especially with travel companies. I made a booking. Now I'm not able to reach a human agent in the night, and that's absolutely frustrating. Right? Customers absolutely love it, right? The resolution time has gone down dramatically. The average handling time has gone down dramatically because now the machine is handling everything, right? Voice agents are becoming better day by day. Their capability to understand speech is becoming better day by day. So what I envisage happening, and this is actually happening, by the way, I'll tell you a few very interesting examples. So people have started using personal assistant AI agents who will just give a call. So let's say I book a trip using booking.com and I have an issue with customer support. So I will have a personal assistant who is an AI agent. It will give a call to booking.com's AI agent. And now the two AI agents will figure it out amongst themselves to find an answer. And this is actually happening, by the way, right? So a year from now, you will start seeing a lot of AI agents talking amongst themselves. B, you will start seeing a lot of AI agents talking to customers, right? And once this piece gets done, then only the spillover will go to human agents. And so then the spillover will go to some human agents who are essentially handling complicated stuff. One of the suggestions I would have is if somebody's in customer support, then they should absolutely consider upskilling and becoming an AI prompt engineer. It's not that hard. It will probably take about 3 to 6 months of dedicated learning to actually do it. And if you become an AI prompt engineer, then you become extremely relevant within the same organization. Because organizations that are using elaborate softwares to do customer support, elaborate AI agents to do customer support, Now they need a lot more people who can do prompt engineering, who know how to do prompt testing. And people who come with business context, they are the best suited people to do that. By the way, this is a philosophy that we also follow, right? So some of the prompt engineers that we're hiring right now, they come from customer support background because they have the business context. They know how to prompt an AI and we just want to train them and upskill them. But I think this is going to be the evolution where some people will move into prompt engineering. People are not able to move. They will just become redundant.
Okay. Let's go move on to the community mentorship leadership part, like most the human side of the podcast. I understood that you mentor and invest in other founders, right? So how has that shaped your own growth as a leader?
I think that's an excellent question. So I think it's a very humbling experience. So once you invest in some startups, I think you realize that there is no way to actually predict what is going to be successful and what is not going to be successful. So I have actually not been investing very actively after I started Robillon. But otherwise, I've invested in about 12 odd startups. And just to give an anecdote, the startup in my portfolio that has actually done the best, they were about to be bankrupted 2 times. And most of the startups that were like heavily VC funded, they've actually not done that well. So I think it's hard to predict what will work, what will not work. And that itself is a very humbling experience because otherwise you tend to feel everything is under control. And once you do this, you see the journey of other founders, you realize that maybe a lot of things are not under control. The second thing I think, and this is from the journey of other founders that I've seen, you need to stay true to the customers, right? You need to, every day you need to think about why am I actually building this company? What is the value that the product adds? And what will I do today to improve the value that my product will bring to my customers? Companies that continuously do it on a day-to-day basis, they're actually the best companies. And these are the companies that will essentially grow. And the third thing would essentially be, there is no winning formula, right? Especially if you're doing an angel investment or you're writing early stage checks, then the only way to figure out, or probably the only way to invest, is essentially invest in people whom you think are more passionate and better problem solvers than yourselves. So you need to think that, hey, I have this money. If I had to take a call to not invest the money in me, who else would I invest the money in? And it is all about the founders. If you trust the founders, if you think they're great founders, they will be able to figure out a solution no matter what. And if that founder fit does not happen, you can be building in the best of spaces and nothing comes out of it.
Yeah. So you believe that, do you believe that the founder, the person is more important than the product or the problem that they try to solve?
Absolutely. 100%. So if you're doing early stage investment and if you're doing angel investment or probably a pre-seed investment or maybe seed investment, founders and founding teams are the only thing that matter. And I've had this conversation a few times with different VCs. See, funds tend to, and this has become even more prevalent now because of whatever has happened in the VC ecosystem in the past 3 years. Funds who try to overanalyze, it just does not add any value, right? And it just does not make any sense. Maybe you can have a couple of parameters where the founders and the team is probably about 70, 80% of the decision. And maybe about the rest of the decision might be around the market or the problem that you're solving. But founders and team is the only thing that matters this early.
Okay. You build in India, scale globally. What cultural lessons have most influenced your leadership style?
I think this is a great question, right? So I've been speaking with companies both in India and US. It is, the way I would put it is, the culture is completely different. The way people buy software, that is completely different. The expectation of how mature the product is completely different. India still has access to cheaper workforce, right? And hence a lot of things that should ideally be automated, people are not very keen to automate them because it is not economically viable to do it. When you move to the US market, that is completely different. If you're not automating, then there is actually a big problem. And it's a huge issue if you're not automating because the workforce is extremely expensive. Things become probably not so efficient and people think very differently. Companies in the US market, they want better products, more finished products. They're keen to buy vertical products where a product can solve only one small piece of the problem, but maybe not the entire problem. And they're okay to buy three or four different point solutions. When you move to the Indian market, it is completely different. People are looking for platforms that do everything. People absolutely hate buying like point solutions, which is very surprising. So when I started speaking with customers in the US market, and even if like when I do that even now, people need more depth in the product. People need products that can do one thing, but they can do it significantly better. People want things that are fully automated, not partially automated, right? So everything is different. Behavior is different. Buying pattern is different. Everything is different. And that has actually taught me and the team a lot of what we have been doing over the last 1.5 years.
Okay, thank you, Dinesh. I'm enjoying a lot of these conversations. Very kind of organic. So yeah, I've got a few more questions left for you. What does success look like for Robilong 5 years from now?
So we want to build a modern age CRM. And the way we look at it is there have been traditional CRMs that had been human agent first. The modern CRM will be AI agent first, where human agent will only handle very small piece of everything. And essentially, your AI agents will handle most of the things, right? So that's the core hypothesis which is there. 5 years from now, we want to have this great platform that most of the companies are using, doing about $100 to $200 million ARR, selling to almost every e-commerce and fintech company across most of the developed market. That's broadly what it looks like. And we have been developing the product really well. We have been focusing on the GTM, et cetera. But essentially, a modern age CRM is what we have started building. And that's the objective to achieve in 5 years.
Okay, that's great. Okay, let's go a bit deep. Okay, now that's the deepest question of the interview. But let you know in advance. So if your younger self could see where you are now, I think that you achieved so much. So what would surprise him most about this AI journey? Not just AI journey, but your entrepreneurial journey.
I think that's an excellent question. Yeah. So I think as a founder, you learn a lot. And that's, I think, the best thing about being a founder. So when I started in 2014, and that was just a plunge that I took, I was not sure that I want to be a founder. I did not know what a founder journey is going to look like, right? Now, if I look at how I used to think at that point of time and what has changed over the years, I think the biggest surprise would be patience, right? When you start the journey and when you're young, you have not worked with a lot of people. And I honestly believe this is probably the biggest and the best trait that all founders need to have. They need to be very good in understanding people. This helps you in hiring the right set of people. This helps you in working with the right set of people. This helps you in understanding how much can each person do, get the best out of them, get the most productivity out of them, etc. And once you do this over a certain number of years, you actually become extremely patient. Like you do not lose your patience very easily, that people learn over a period of time, and that becomes extremely important. The second thing would be, and at the age of 24, when I started the first company, I underestimated how much I would need to learn and overestimated how much I knew, right? And a lot of thought process was that, hey, I know maybe a lot or enough, and that should be good enough to help me build the company. But every single day, and then eventually every single week or every single month, you are humbled by things that you do not know. And as a founder, you cannot resign to that, right? You need to be extremely motivated and driven to keep on learning new things. And that's the fun part, right? You keep on learning new things, and that helps you upskill, that helps you become a better founder. And that has been like a massive change in the thought process, right? Now, learning as a founder is an accepted part of the process. And I absolutely understand that, hey, this is how things happen, and this is how the things will move. And I think the third thing would be, so when I was starting up, I did not actually appreciate how hard it would be, right? Which I do now. So I think building a company is very hard and there are no shortcuts to it. So journeys which look extremely glamorous from the outside, from what is being posted on social media, LinkedIn, Instagram, etc., I do not know any founder whose journey has been easy, right? But that's how it is, right? So after I sold the first company, I ended up exiting. A bunch of people who were there in my core team in Asan Jobs, they were starting up. So about 5 companies came out of our core team. And whenever somebody would come to me for an advice that, hey, what should we do? My general suggestion would be, if you can be anybody else in this world, don't be a founder. And then I would tell them that, hey, it's very hard to build a company. And if you want to sign up for that, be very sure that this is the only thing that you believe you want to do. So luckily, all 5 of them, like they have been running companies for about 4 or 5 years now. All 5 of them came back and said that, hey, you did not tell properly how hard it is going to be. And that's a learning that you get only after you build companies, right? So yeah, so I think as a younger self, I would be surprised to see how difficult it is actually to build companies, which you cannot see from outside. It's very hard to appreciate that.
Thank you very much for sharing this. That was, yeah, I totally agree with you, actually. Okay. Thank you very much, Dinesh, for your making time for this interview. I have a lot of fun. I've learned a lot from this chat as well. Yeah, thank you.
Same here. Thanks a lot for taking the time. Love the conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Humans and AI podcast. We are here to spotlight the people making AI more human. One story at a time. See you in the next episode.